Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really amazing guest. You know, we're going to be learning quite a bit, you know, on what they're up to. You know, really remarkable. They're building a rocket ship. We're talking about a valuation of over $3 billion. The last round was over $600 million in one go. So let that sink in. We're going to be talking about, you know, basically the main motivations behind starting the business, how they went about raising money, from where, what were some of the frustrations along the way, as well as the frustrations of being an innovator in a world and in a segment that is heavily regulated, as well as to how you unlock or not support from government. So again, very inspiring conversation, the one that we have ahead of us. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Mark Slack. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. Delighted to be here.
So originally born and raised in South Africa. So give us a walk memory lane. How was life growing up over there?
Yeah, it was interesting. Yes, very much born and bred family from 2-3 generations there. It was difficult times in South Africa. Politically, it was a strange time. It was in the time of apartheid. So as white people, we were very privileged. My parents were very left-wing, liberal, anti-apartheid. And so we were brought up complaining about the government. But I went to school there. It was very peaceful. It was very... We were encouraged to take part in sport. And yes, a very sad time as well because of the apartheid discrimination against people basically on their color alone. And very pleased to say those days are gone in my home country.
That's incredible. So you were actually a champion athlete. So how do you think that competitiveness, you know, has fueled, you know, you as well on who you are and how you tackle, you know, life to as an entrepreneur?
Well, I often employ people who come from athletic backgrounds and champion athletic backgrounds because I know they have a competitiveness in them. I was extremely competitive. I was a middle distance runner. I played a lot of sports, but the one I really excelled in was middle distance. I had ambitions to go to the Olympics one day, which were beaten by injury. And that itself, when I started getting injuries, I maintained motivation. I didn't give up. I then moved my attention to academia and got into university to study and read medicine. So in many ways, it drove me towards what I ended up doing as a profession.
Okay. So then in your case too, I mean, injuries really push you in a different direction.
Yeah. It introduced me to doctors that I saw and admired what they were doing. And it also meant I'd lost something I wanted. And it gave you the motivation to succeed in something else.
So then let's talk about you getting into medical school, because obviously you're like, you know, maybe there is something here for me to explore as an alternative.
Yeah, I mean, medical school was an interesting one because I'd been such a high level athlete, my marks weren't that good. And when I decided I wanted to go to medical school, my teacher said, well, there's a problem. You don't have high enough marks. I said, well, what do I need to do to get in? They said, well, you have to work bloody hard. So I settled down for my last year at school, worked incredibly hard to get the grades you needed to get a first-class pass to be able to apply for medical school, and applied and got in. So that was good. It was and very exciting, you know, the world of medicine. I found it something I really enjoyed. There were challenges. You had to learn a lot. And to be good at it, you really needed a dedication. So yes, a great profession.
So then, I mean, quite impressive that you decided to really go, you know, and into the army, into the service there, and all of a sudden you find yourself being a doctor in the middle of battlefield. I mean, I'm sure that was quite shocking and transformative for you.
Well, it was quite weird because in South Africa we had conscription, so you weren't entitled to decide whether you wanted to go to army. You either went to the army or you went to jail or you left the country, but then you could not go back. I then went in. I went as a doctor. So I volunteered to go to Angola, so I wouldn't be serving against a South African. And I served as a combat medic. So I flew what we would call medivacs. We flew in helicopters to pick people up who who were injured, bring them back, operate on them, and then take them back to South Africa. And I also served supporting Angolan soldiers from one of the rebel armies for a while. So a very interesting time. Learned a lot about myself, learned a lot about strength of character, and learned a lot about discipline.
So then in this case, you know, quite transformative, obviously, as you were saying, you know, learning a lot about discipline. How do you find yourself all of a sudden landing in the UK?
Now, that goes back to I was very worried that the South African government would never give up, that they would never break apartheid. And I thought that it was just going to end in a conflagration and a terrible war. So I made a decision to go and try the UK. When I got to the UK, I got involved in research. I got involved in subspecialization, which I really enjoyed. And so partly because of the politics in South Africa and partly because of the opportunities in the UK, I moved into the UK and have been here ever since and have really enjoyed living here and have enjoyed my professional life here.
So then let's talk about getting into Cambridge too and hitting it on the research side of things, because that has been, you know, quite pivotal for you.
Yes. So I got into my subspecialization and came into Cambridge. I ended up as the head of gynecology in the university hospital. I was doing a lot of research in my subspecialty. So we did work in pharmaceutical work. We also did research in surgery, different operations, which was fantastic to do. Plus, there was a huge supporting network. You can't have an ego in Cambridge. There's so many talented people around you, so many people bright. More Nobel laureates walking around Cambridge than there are in most countries of the world. And so that was a very inspiring place to be. And I had some ideas as well. I started getting interested in the business side of medicine. So some of my ideas we developed at Johnson & Johnson, and they took over as products for me and took them to global launch. So I'd got the good experience in taking an idea, onto the business side and taking it through as a business case and, yeah, taking it to launch.
So before that, you were also seeing a lot of things. You know, you were even involved in the whole thing, you know, of implants that ended up, becoming dangerous. So obviously, you know, some of those things that you were doing, that you were seeing, kind of like push you in this direction too. So what were some of those things that you were experiencing that kind of like started to fuel that thought process, that frustration, you know, that led you eventually to become an entrepreneur?
You know, I think one of the things is to be a good entrepreneur or an inventor or anything, you need to also be a very good observer. And you need to be an observer and honest. When you see things that are different from the normal, you've got to be willing to think, oh, that's different. And then you look at it and explore it and see whether something can be done. So you say the implants, they were using plastic implants for types of surgery. They use them for hernias. And in females, they were using it for prolapse operations. And I was aware that many, many years ago, 30 years ago, they tried this with not great results. And I was very, very interested. So I started looking at it. I then did work experiments in animals, and I did tree-based work, which confirmed my suspicions that these implants weren't a good thing and shouldn't be put in humans as they were being put, and started lecturing on that, talking about it. And ultimately, these became found to be bad. There was a huge amount of publicity around it, and it went to large class actions in the United States. I was the expert witness in quite a few of them as groups of patients sued the companies. So that was also a good reminder to me that if you're going to do innovations in medicine, if you're going to do innovations in surgery, you've got to be sure that what you're doing is safe. And you follow the rules that you do good, safe medical introductions so patients do not get harmed. So that was a really inspiring time of my life. But I've always been an observer. I've always criticized many, many years ago when my wife had our first child. She had quite a big hemorrhage and they wanted to transfuse her, and I wouldn't let them because I was scared of blood. I thought there were many dangers associated with blood. And that, again, got me in a lot of trouble with my seniors. Felt, why was I interfering in the management? But my wife didn't have a blood transfusion, which was good. And I went through, you know, my career talking more on blood, doing more work on it. And in fact, now in 2024, the data shows that blood, of course, has some value, but in most cases, it's not valuable. In 58% of transfusions, they think it's harmful. So it was that observation that I was willing to observe things, do different and be different. It doesn't make you popular necessarily. People can get quite cross with you when you challenge what the normal is, and you've got to be a little bit thick-skinned as an innovator to go ahead and with your ideas and do it differently. And then, of course, I started questioning the way surgery is being done, which is why I got around to building a robot.
So let's talk about the company. Let's talk about CMR Surgical. What ended up being the business model? How are you guys making money?
Well, we started off, there were five of us who wanted to build a robot to help with keyhole surgery. Keyhole surgery is very useful. It massively reduces complications in surgery compared with open surgery, but it's very difficult to do. And a very significant number of surgeons can't do keyhole surgery, just too technically difficult. And we thought a robot might help that, because with a robot, you get three-dimensional view, you get a magnification of the view, you have instruments that have articulated wrists. It's all the functions are made easier, but the robots that were available in the market, I didn't like. They were too big, too expensive. They made you change many things. So we set out to build a robot that replicated the sort of robots, the surgery that you did with standard keyhole surgery. And that's what we've done. So ours is quite small, very neat, and it enables you to do keyhole surgery in exactly the way you did it when you're holding it with your arm. But a greater number of surgeons can do it. It's more accurate, it's more precise, and so on. So that was the model. Now, number two, you've got to get a robot that fits into the flow of the hospital. You know, some of the big robots, you have to knock down walls to put them in. You have to reinforce the floor, raise the roof. Ours just fits in a normal theater, no disruption to the normal flow. It goes in. Training is relatively easy. We have training programs on it. And then what you want to do is have that robot working 5-6 days a week. That then reduces the cost of it, and it becomes a robot that is affordable for the health system to use.
So you guys have raised also quite a bit of money. How much have you guys raised to date?
Right. So our first raise was about, we raised a tiny amount of money. We were very lucky. A guy liked and heard our story and gave us enough money for the founders to leave their day jobs and start building. So we went from a computer-generated image to operating in humans in 5 years, which is an incredible record. We then raised about $300 million and we employed many more people, got buildings, started building the robot. And then in 2021, we raised $660 million, which at the time was a med tech record. And that gave the company a market cap of about $3 billion. And enabled us to expand the building, to mature the robot and build it to a situation and for it to be sold in multiple countries.
Hey, guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone, it's super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So With that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out.
And I mean, one of the raises was over 600 million. I mean, that sounds like a lot of money in one go. How do you go about doing that?
No, it is a lot of money. I mean, 2021 was a good time to be raising money, but we had a very credible story. You know, we were able to show the advantages of minimal access surgery, but the fact that not many sold, you know, in the United States, only 40% of people get keyhole surgery. 60% of people still get open surgery with all the complications. So we could show that. Then we could show how keyhole could reduce complications, but difficult to do, and therefore the robot could help that. We had been very clever and sensible. We had done early research. We had published it, so we were able to show the people how many cases we had done, the results we were getting from it, how long it was taking us to train people. And so all along the way, we've had evidence, and we've had been able to demonstrate what we claim and so on. So it wasn't just guessing. We could say, you know, we've done now so many patients. The other thing we did is from the very beginning, Alessandro, we put a registry in place. So every single patient operated on by the robot went into the registry. So when we'd say done 2,000 cases and someone said, well, is your robot safe? I could say, well, we've done 2,000 cases and we've had complications in X and they've done well, et cetera, et cetera. So we had all the results all the time. And we published that. When we got to 2,900 patients, we published those results in a big American journal. So, you know, people could see not only had we built this incredible, my co-founder, Luke, who actually designed the robot, is a genius in many respects. I mean, all the other robots are 5'8", 5'10" tall. They weigh 600 kilograms. Ours is tiny, small, 5'6" tall, folds up into a 38 by 38 centimeter footprint and sit against the wall. And Lucas, you know, got it, but in order to get people to find it, we had the safety and we could demonstrate the training and we could demonstrate the advantage from quite an early stage. So when we went for the big raise, we were able to say we've done X number of patients, good results, et cetera, et cetera. And people were very excited.
So let's talk about also the frustrations that you guys have had to embrace, because when you are executing on a segment like this, it's obviously as well heavily regulated. So not only you have the uncertainty of building a business, but then also dealing with regulation. So how did you go about combining both and executing?
Yeah, regulations are real on an innovator's nightmare. Now, I'm not against regulation. We have to have regulation to make sure that medical devices are safe, that they are introduced safely, that they are used safely on people. But the trouble is regulations are designed to try and prevent disasters that have happened in the past. But very often the disasters have happened because of bad behavior on behalf of companies, almost criminality, rather than, you know, sort of a lack of regulation. And they build regulations that won't prevent problems in the future, but will add to the costs. And if you put too big a regulatory framework around it, that slows innovation hugely and it raises cost massively. And if you're a startup company, you have a burn rate and you have a certain amount of money. And, you know, trials are very, very expensive. A big clinical trial can cost you $3 million. Easily, you know. So, and there's a misunderstanding between devices and drugs. The top drugs in the world, $20 billion a year per drug they earn. The biggest med tech company in the world is Medtronic. They, as a company, make $20 billion a year. They have 800 products. So the return on investment in a tech company is way less than in a pharmaceutical company. And yet they're trying to put the same regulatory framework on tech as they do on pharma. And that's just not going to work. And there are ways, there are propositions by academics to do the regulation more efficiently, more affordably, and better. And I think, you know, and that's using things like real world data. We live in the world of data. We have databases. We can have registries of outcomes. We can put thousands of patients on relatively affordably, not just traditional clinical trials. We need to think of modern ways of curating data, keeping data, and proving safety of these devices.
So then let's talk about how you unlock help from government. You know, how do you go about that?
Now, that's a difficult one. Now, the United States does that, I think, quite well. If you build a factory for your company in the United States, they will very often provide supplementary funding and help for people. In Europe, that's far less common. You know, I'm in the UK. We've built a factory in the UK. We got no help in building that factory. You know, it's in an area which needs employment. It will provide employment. We could become a multi-billion dollar company and bringing income into the, and you would think that a country would unlock regulation a little bit, would provide support. Even you've heard of the National Health Service, which we have in the United Kingdom. And when I sell a robot to hospitals in the National Health Service, I get no advantages of any other country. I go into the same tender process. And the fact, and whereas when I go to India and I'm selling a robot in India, the Indian government has a policy called Made in India. And if I'm selling against a robot that was built in India, they get advantages over me. So governments should think about supporting homegrown businesses and getting them started so that they can get to a point that they can compete internationally.
So then, obviously, you know, incredible what you guys are up to, you know, the fact that you've been able to raise, you know, all that money too, and how you're serving, you know, folks. I think that vision is a really big one, no? And something that has helped with propelling all of the incredible work that you guys are doing. So to that effect, Mark, if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of the company is fully realized, what does the world look like?
Well, that's the one I really do love. So my aim was multifold. When I came to start this, I said I wanted to prove that you could build a very successful medtech company that could make a profit ethically and safely for the patients. So I would like to see now the biggest company, robotic company in the world, is an American company called Intuitive. They occupy about 4% of the minimal access market worldwide. They occupy a higher percentage in America. And they have a market cap of about 180 billion. Okay. So if we woke up and we had the success I wanted, we would remain in control of our own company. We would be supplying a significant percentage of the robotic market for Keyhole, just say 10%. I would like to think we are a company with a market cap of close to 200 billion, and we are building robots internationally, selling to both the high income countries and the low and middle income countries at the right price. So it is an affordable system, improving healthcare, and to make a profit is not a problem. But I would like to make that profit while we are improving health, and we're providing it to the world. So my busiest robot that I have in the world is in Pakistan. And it's a low and middle income country. And it works satisfactorily in a lower income. Likewise, we have robots in England and France and Germany. So high income countries. So my dream would be a large footprint in all over the world, supplying both high income and low and middle income and delivering outstanding healthcare. And to do that, we would also be supporting and funding excellent medical research so that the robot just developed, got better and better, both medically and engineering wise.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. So Mark, let's talk about now the past and doing so with a lens of reflection. Imagine I put you in a time machine, you know, and I bring you back to maybe 2014, you know, or maybe 2013, where you were starting to incubate the thought of doing something. And let's say you're able to show up and see that younger self and be able to tell that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
So the one, yeah, there are lots of pieces of advice. The one big piece of advice is get a mentor. I came from a non-business background. So in the early days when I sat with my fellow, and when the business people started joining us, I would look at my phone with Google, you know, what's a CAGR, what's the difference between net profit, etc. So knowledge, I think a business mentor is a very good thing, a more senior person, someone who's been there before, someone who you can share your thoughts with and be guided, that's one. Number two, always keep an incredibly close eye on the spend. Keep a very close eye on expansion. In some areas, we expanded too fast. You know, keep small. Always earn ahead of spending. And keep a very open mind, which I do. But the things would be a mentor. And the other thing is try as hard as possible not to lose control of the company to investors, which ultimately most of us have to do. So when you get a big investment like we did, then you lose control. And I think ultimately you would try and hold on to control.
Those are incredible, incredible things there. And I'm sure that they're going to inspire all the people that are listening, Mark. So thank you for sharing that. For the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
LinkedIn. I'm on Mark Slack on LinkedIn. And it's very easy to email me through my company on mark.slack@cmrsurgical.com. And I'm pretty good with responding to people.
Well, easy enough, Mark. Well, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us, Mark.
It's been an honor to be with you. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you very much for inviting me.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.